Okay, well, if anybody has a yacht parked in Buzzards Bay, you are excused. And as you'll see, there's a hurricane making right for the path. We had an animated track of it before, but this particular computer does not have shockwave flash, so we're stuck with just a plain static graphic. Let's see if we can get this going. Is this microphone working? I feel like a game show host. We actually have sufficient technology for tic-tac-toe, but let's see, view show. All right, I think we're ready to roll. So welcome to this, the second installment of Internet Society Technology Politics Control, where we're going to be continuing to talk about ICANN today, and then moving into a preview of next week, which is crypto stuff. See what happens. Oh yeah, and here's actually an entire roadmap for what is to happen today, including on ICANN, and then we're going to have sort of an interlude where whatever pressure has mounted over technical glitches, bad rotisseries, weird cranks, and I mean both cranks of rotisserie and just weird cranks, we can talk about that in the sort of intermediate time, and then we move on to the crypto stuff. Also, during that intermediate time, we'll be talking about some of the special projects that were mentioned last week, and there'll be an opportunity to sign up for them. It's a dazzling array of special projects. One of the things that having such a huge class is a benefit, because somebody is bound to want to do each of them. But if you don't, and it just seems like an amazing amount of confusion, and this is an experiment at which no variables are being held constant, you can safely ignore all of the stuff about special projects and just write a paper at the end, and it won't be very stressful. So that brings us to ICANN. You know what? Let me back off for a second. ICANN, okay. How many people have been getting lots of email, either from me, from somebody associated with me, from somebody who seems to be friends with me? Okay. At first I felt somewhat bad about this, and then I decided get used to it. It's an internet class. I promised that the medium would be the message, so you'll be getting a lot of email about this class. I mean, it's an internet class, why not? If that is not what you're used to, you can discover filters. Filters are actually wonderful. If you have, I guess Eudora is the standard system around here, right? Most people are on Eudora. So Eudora, if you have a message, suppose it's one of those ones coming from the bracket names bracket list that we just got working at about 2 in the morning last night. If you actually go up under one of the menus, it says something like make filter. And then it suggests that, oh, I see, every message that starts with bracket names, why don't I put that into a new folder called names? And then as urgent messages are coming in from classmates asking that you're, you know, available for lunch, those go into your regular inbox. And then boring class stuff you don't want to read goes into your names box, and you can just ignore it. So I urge you to discover filters and to consult with me or with Alex or Becca if you need help on configuring them. They can be quite fun and effective, and it's bottom-up governance at its best. So we'll talk more about that, I guess, in the interstitial period. But I wanted to start just by seeing what little picture questions there were on ICANN. Surely somebody who was here for the torrent that was last week's class, and did the reading and started to get the dribble of messages on our new listserv this morning, perhaps there were questions that arose. And at this point, these are little questions. No question is too small to be handled in this plenary session with everyone watching. Anybody have a question? If I were to say that we would not move on until someone asked a question, that would enable the person asking the question to be a hero instead of a... Yes, sir, your name is?
My name is Norbert. I have a following question. What's the relation between the PyTorch, and the ICANN?
The relationship between ISOC and ICANN, ISOC being the Internet Society, which in this alphabet soup of acronyms last week we heard was an incorporated with a headquarters and president front for the IETF, to be putting it somewhat crudely and possibly inaccurately. If you listen to some people, they think that ICANN is simply a front for the Internet Society, which they then take to be about as evil as the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations combined. There's several people who talk about this, one of whom I think is about to join our mailing list, but has not yet, so you'll be hearing from him. But in the meantime, the actual relationship is no formal strings between the two. ICANN has three subordinate supporting organizations. If you look at their bylaws, which was an attempt to get everybody that had an interest, i.e. anybody who could yell if it wasn't to their liking, to give them some place within the organization, the bylaws have a bicameral board for ICANN. Half of it is an at-large board elected by an at-large membership. What is an at-large membership? We don't know yet, but they're working on it. And then the other half is comprising three supporting organizations, a domain name supporting organization, a DNSO, a protocol support organization, a PSO, and an address support organization, an ASO. And these roughly track the functions that John Postel and his crew did before ICANN came about. They managed the top level of domain names, as we saw, the so-called root. They handed out the lower level IP addresses, literally those serial numbers that had to be kept track of. And they also worried about protocols generally, because it was John who was the RFC editor, the guy that did those requests for comments. He was sort of the overall editor of these, and so those were the protocols as they got developed. So each of these is meant to have a structure. Now, we're lucky to have with us today Andrew McLaughlin, who actually was in Washington earlier this morning. The 11 o'clock got canceled, the 10 o'clock was canceled, the 1 o'clock, the 2 o'clock, and the 3 o'clock were all canceled. Andrew got himself on the 12 o'clock and braved a hurricane to be here today. Andrew, to my understanding, is the chief financial officer, the corporate secretary, what else? The general counsel, anything else? And vice president for policy of ICANN. He wears several hats, as you can see. In addition, he's a fellow of the Berkman Center, which makes it awfully convenient to host him here. So he will be in a position shortly to be answering some questions about ICANN, and in particular joining some hard, big questions about ICANN, the ones we're going to get to after we clear up some of the little ones. And I'm hoping that all of us can sort of ask him some questions and have him respond. Other little questions. Oh, you'll notice that as I talk, a summary of what I'm saying is appearing on the right screen. That's coming from Mr. Ben Edelman. Ben is sitting right here. Ben is a sophomore at Harvard College, an absolute technical wizard. Absolute technical wizard. Sometimes a little subversive or, well, anyway. From Ben's fingers come the letters that comprise the words on the paragraphs you see in this corner of the room. This is called scribing, and we've used it at several meetings, including ICANN meetings, at which 300 far more unruly people than the people gathered here come together in one place to scream at each other. And Ben scribing comes up in the corner and laconically documents each scream as it is uttered. So we're going to try it out in this class. After all, we're big, and with any luck, we'll soon be unruly. And Ben is going to help us scribe. Now, since Ben is a sophomore at Harvard College, he has other responsibilities. I'm hoping that somebody here, or some buddies here, may be able to fill his shoes in further weeks. And in lieu of the onerous final paper, volunteer to actually scribe for a class and then write something related to the particular class and topic that was studied that day. And as you can see, I can wax on perfectly incoherently without any organization whatsoever, and Ben manages to put it into little Microsoft Word bullets and, you know, Roman numeral 2 and number 3, that kind of thing. So you'll see that happening. The key is just not to get hypnotized by it. It's very helpful, but the reason we don't have it on the center screen is because then you just start just watching it. And it's not, it's like, I'm not even here. I could be in the next room just talking, and then he just summarizes. But you'll also find that your own words will be scribed by the scribe. When that happens, you should see if he's getting it. He may not be getting it. And in fact, he may be particularly unruly because he knows it's only us rather than an ICANN meeting watching him. And please don't hesitate to correct. Thank you there, Ben. Good demonstration. Just what I wanted. Don't hesitate to correct the record. Indeed, if you think of this in terms of lawyering skills, what record will survive of this class, aside from the audio and video that's being taken, but the scribe's notes? And if you think about it in terms of the arguments that may be made here, in some ways this document may be equally important to what you manage to express to the body of people here today. Yes?
My name is Micah.
What is
the relationship, what kind of a connection is there between ITN and ITN? I mean, I understood that there's sort of
four groups
that come together in one group called the ITN.
Yes.
And how that connects.
I put that question to Dave Clark, who's a guy who appears to be big in the IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force. He's the guy that coined the motto, "We reject kings, presidents, and voting. We believe in rough consensus and running code." And his story is, every time the IETF meeting started to get packed with people who didn't know what they were talking about, like, oh, this is the new Internet, I think I'll attend, you know, so Steve Case shows up. Every time something like that happens, they would come up with a new organization as a decoy. This is what he told me. So there's the Internet Engineering Steering Group, the Internet Architecture Board, et cetera, and ultimately the front ISOC. Now that may have been somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but IETF again represents a set of norms, the DAO that you read, that you found in the readings for this week. The IETF is that, and the group of people that come together on the mailing lists in cyberspace and in the real in-person meetings that get organized. ISOC is an actual corporation. It has a treasury. It collects dues. You pay to belong to ISOC. One of the problems ISOC had at the very beginning was how to structure dues so that they would be internationally fair, because you can, you know, the Big Mac quotient says one Big Mac in America doesn't equal one Big Mac elsewhere in currency. So I think they actually tied it to Big Macs or baskets of goods or something like that. So there are differential dues, but you pay them. There are chapters. And then the chapters of ISOC come together and elect a board and a president. And of course, ISOC has its share of politics as well. There's a story told by someone of the battle over control of the Thailand ISOC chapter, which briefly, due to a sudden, inexplicable slew of registrations, became the biggest ISOC chapter in the world, promptly voted in a particular person who was not particularly active before, and then I think was decertified by the larger ISOC for having followed the rules and elected someone. Again, I'm probably getting the story somewhat wrong. But that's the connection, as it were. And if you look at the officers and people involved with ISOC, there's great overlap between the movers and shakers of the IETF and the ISOC. Also, I believe, Andrew can clear this up at some point soon, the IETF has agreed to be or be part of the protocol support organization of ICANN. So that's how the IETF is connecting, even if ISOC isn't connecting that way. Good questions. Other questions? Yes?
As I was reading through the readings, I noticed that there wasn't much mention of commercial interests on the net. And it seems to me that the fact that the net got really big commercially at all interested in what's going on the net in the first place. So I'm wondering players like Cisco or Yahoo or AOL think about how the TLDs are going to work out, how ICANN fits into
everything. In a minute, I'm going to ask Andrew actually to give his insight into that. As a structural matter, rest assured that commercial interests are well represented in the process. They somehow make their views known, and the results tend not to be too far afield from what they want, in my experience seeing it. On the other hand, commercial interests have this odd characteristic whereby if you ask them what they think, they don't necessarily want to tell you. And if you throw an open meeting and invite everyone, they're not going to send anybody. Or if they do, they will send someone merely as an observer who will sort of take notes and then go away and that's it. Corporations and commercial interests live in an environment where big open meetings with scribes aren't the way that they exercise their influence. They do it in other ways. And one of the debates over the processes that form ICANN, to my mind, has been the more we keep it open, kind of new constitutional convention for the 21st century, the less the commercial interests feel comfortable in that mode. They say, I don't want to have to come to a meeting and get 5 minutes exactly at a microphone, like a school board, and say what I think to the board. I want to call them up on the phone, tell them what I think, and have it be known that they know what I think. So it's hard. You can guess where they might be coming from. And sometimes the trade associations say so. But they have a different view towards open processes, by and large, than the other people who may have been, in our readings at least, better represented. Andrew, is there something you want to add to that?
Sure. It is a really interesting question. There are two kind of axes along which the introduction to commercialism of the internet governs the structure. Interesting. One is that it's funny, when you talk about internet engineers, like the people who take part in the IETF, virtually all of them work for large commercial companies. They work for AT&T, Lucent, Bell Labs, they work for Cisco, or Recon, something like that. But they don't actually usually talk very much to their management, and their management often has very different business goals and objectives, and so
apparently this works better.
Yeah. All right. So I'll click this on. So what happened is when business started to move on to the World Wide Web and the internet began to be seen as an engine for commerce, is that these businesses looked around and they realized that the infrastructure that supports their business activities wasn't managed or administered in any way that they were familiar with. I mean, a business now, if it wants a zoning change, the business knows that it can go hire 10 lobbyists, they can camp out in front of the local zoning commission, and you know, you can make your case and you can get the changes made. With the internet, if there's something wrong with the domain name system or the way that you allocate IP addresses, the only way that you can go about making those changes back in the old days was to talk to this one guy at the University of Southern California and see what he had to say, and he would basically say nothing except go talk to the IETF or build your own internet. And so that was not really satisfying to business. So what ICANN represents in a way is a place where business and commercial interests can feel comfortable that they can sit down with the techies and everybody else to try to resolve these problems. It remains to be seen if this is going to be successful or work out. I don't think if we really know if the techies and the commercial enterprises are going to get along in the way that they profess they want to. But that's what ICANN is supposed to do, is to provide a forum where everybody with a significant interest in it gets a voice. So far, the business community has been strongly supportive of ICANN, with one notable exception, which is the monopoly registrar for domain names. But otherwise, just about all of ICANN's funding up until now has come from Microsoft, MCI, AT&T, and these other big companies. The ones that invest billions of dollars in the internet and that want, they have an economic incentive to have a stable management structure that is technically based but responsive to commercial concerns. That's what ICANN tries to do.
So as you may have noticed, Andrew, in addition to all the other functions he serves for ICANN, is their spokesperson in large part. They have a PR agency, but they also have Andrew. And Andrew speaks quite frequently to reporters, tracking down the latest story on ICANN, and gives the company view. He'll often do it even on background so that he can provide the full story. So in a sense, you can think of Andrew as being here to do just that. And as long as we're thinking of him in that way, I'm happy now to go to some of the bigger questions that help explain why we're even spending a week and a half talking directly about ICANN, setting up a list about it, and in some ways making it the theme for the course. So here's an equation. The equation is ICANN equals internet governance. Is that equation true or false?
Absolutely false. ICANN does technical coordination, not governance. Now that's the party line. Now the truth is that what ICANN is doing is a lot like governance. But governance is a very loaded word, and it's one that we stay away from with a 10-foot pole. We don't go anywhere near it. And that's because, I'll give a Clinton-like answer, which is it depends what governance means. I mean, if governance means making decisions about a resource that ought to be managed in the public interest, then yes, we make decisions about resources that ought to be managed in the public interest. If what it means is, are you a global democracy, the answer is no. And the reason for the emphatic
global
no...
Global dictatorship.
Global, that's right, global domination through technical coordination. The reason for the emphatic no to that, though, in all seriousness, is that ICANN is an entity with a limited mandate that occupies an extremely precarious perch, which is to say that by becoming the first globally representative, private sector-led, governance-like institution, there are going to be a lot of temptations for ICANN to range beyond the narrow tasks that it's been given to do. This is generally perceived as being a bad thing with a capital BT. ICANN is supposed to make decisions that ensure that domain names get assigned uniquely, that IP addresses get allocated uniquely, that protocol port numbers get assigned uniquely, and that the root server system, which stands at the top of all of this, operates in a smooth, technically robust manner. That's its charter. And what we don't want ICANN to become is some kind of a content determiner, you know, somebody who goes out and makes decisions about what can and can't appear on the web. Now, we blur the lines already, and one way in which we do that is that ICANN is in the process of providing special protections for trademarked speech in the form of a uniform dispute resolution system that will allow trademark owners to get an expedited review process to resolve their disputes against cyber squatters. That is, in our view, a necessary ancillary to the technical task of ensuring unique assignment of individual domain names. But other people make a plausible case that it is actually content control in favor of trademark interests. They say, why don't you then go out and shut down websites that have copyright violations on them? And actually, that is a technically plausible thing that ICANN could conceivably do someday, despite the sort of procedural protections and checks and balances that are built into our overall structure. We say there's no way in hell we would ever do that. We don't want to go anywhere near content regulation. We're just sticking with trademarks. But even that's kind of strange and unprincipled in a certain way, which is to say that we just got an email the other day from an Islamic clergy group in Pakistan that said, here is a list of domain names that are blasphemous to Islam. Please exclude them from the domain name system. You know, it's a slippery slope, and in a way we've already entered it even by treading on trademarks. So. For that reason, we say, no, we're not a governance institution. We do technical coordination and the narrow band of...
Oh, that's not true.
It is true in a manner of speaking. It's true to me in a way that's meaningful, which is to say that we are a globally representative entity that is, they'll try to be anyway, a globally representative entity that makes decisions about public resources.
So Andrew has spent a lot of time thinking about this and a lot of time talking about this, and as you can see, is even able to present two sides of the different arguments as they emerge. But I'd love to spin them out in a little more detail in order to help us see if we can arrive at a consensus as to whether this equation either is true or false or is somehow the wrong question to be asking, and we need to fill in different words. To do that, actually, I asked Ben to put together another experiment. Let's just see how this works. This will, you know, we're all learning together here with all variables in play. Ben, if you would press the space to begin. Is there a Miguel Danielson in the room? Mr. Danielson. Nothing up my sleeve. The computer just picked your name. What's the worst? Everybody else is like, oh my God. I actually got to start paying attention. See, this is the way to stop people from playing solitaire once they have the laptop. Okay, so, Ben, you don't have to just. Oh, no. So, spin it out a little. What's the worst case scenario you can think of for an ICANN run amok? What's the worst thing it could do from what you've read and from what you know? And if there's something you don't know, feel free to ask a question back to fill in what might be the worst case. Just one, that's all.
I guess that it would be out of control, and that its policies would go out of the... It would not correspond to what the, you know, constituency of the Internet wants it to be.
But, okay, to borrow a phrase from law, what is ICANN's jurisdiction? What's the area in which it could do things that might be against what Internet people want? What could it ban or proscribe? What could it force people to do?
You mean on a technical level or...
I don't know. We're trying to develop a nightmare scenario for an ICANN run amok. And surely, procedurally speaking, if ICANN were to do a bunch of things that weren't in agreement with what people generally wanted, that would be bad. I'm just trying to figure out, as an antecedent matter, what are the sorts of things that it could do? I mean, it couldn't regulate, you know, whether you salt French fries at McDonald's. That wouldn't have any power to do it, even if it were to make a decision contrary to what the American people want. So what are the sorts of things it could try to weigh in on?
Well, I mean, just the policies that it creates for whatever technical, for the things that NSI does, it can control of those, it can do lots of things, it can prevent anyone from owning or obtaining ownership of the domain names they want. And that has lots of different repercussions. Outside of just not having a domain name.
So,
using the domain name,
So this is good. This is what Andrew was starting to allude to. ICANN's enforcement mechanism for any policy it might want to establish. At the end of the day, the most simple enforcement mechanism it has is to try to deny someone a domain name. To tell CNN.com, guess what? CNN.com is now going to Cora Niels Nelson, not to you, CNN. It might have the power to do it. Now, how would it have the power to do that? Just to make sure we break it down into components to show how this regime is or is not built up. ICANN does not run the database that everybody listens to that says where CNN.com goes. That's run by Network Solutions. However, ICANN is in process of entering into a contract with Network Solutions, as is the government entering into a contract with Network Solutions. And in that contract, they might specify that Network Solutions is the hatchet person. In the event that X, Y, and Z happens, you are to disable a domain name. Now, the example that Andrew gave was trademark, that there might be certain disputes that could arise for which, if they get resolved one way or another, Network Solutions would be compelled to take away the name from one party and give it to another. But the other thing Andrew alluded to was the Pakistani example that might say, ICANN could say to Network Solutions in a contract, if Network Solutions were inclined to sign it, if we give you instructions signed by the following three people of ICANN to turn off the following domain name in your database, you agree to do it or face the following liquidated damages. Now, you might also say, why would Network Solutions ever agree to that contract? Now, who's they? When you say they, do you mean NSI? Now, do you want to take this in?
Yeah, Network Solutions does it all the time. Hundreds of cases every year where they shut down a domain name through the dispute resolution process. What's worth noting about that is that Network Solutions has had this kind of ad hoc policy that's developed over the years because they didn't want to get sued. And so in order to not get sued, they had a policy that said, well, show us some evidence that you got a trademark, we'll then put the name on hold, we'll then have an arbitrator come in and look at it, and then we'll decide what to do. Everybody's actually pretty much hated that policy. And it wasn't incidentally limited just to trademarks. It was anybody with a legitimate interest in the name, and they would try to weigh sort of superseding interests. ICANN solution, in simplest form, is that the orders to the registrar are do nothing unless a court tells you to, except in one little narrow area of cases that has to do with trademarks. And there's sort of this three-part test where you say, does the challenger have a legally protected interest in the name, aka a trademark? Does the holder have no legitimate interest in the name? And is there some evidence of bad faith? The no interest in the name prong is designed to get at what we call fair use speech and political dissident speech, so that AOLsucks.com is perfectly permissible because it's got a legitimate use, which is to criticize the trademark holder. And similarly, Veronica.com can be held by little Veronica, you know, two-month-old little Veronica Smith, even though Archie Comics has a comical character named Veronica. It's supposed to cover those cases, and then the bad faith component is designed to get at those instances in which the holder is trying to extort money from the legitimate owner of the name. It's not our solution, but it's what your point goes to, and just to bring it back to the track that Jonathan was on, it's really important to notice what it is that I can control. So we get this question all the time. They say, what's your authority? Now, what gives you the right to tell anybody to do anything? And actually, it's incredibly flimsy. What we have is a single computer file that has about 262 lines, and that's it.
Do you have that file?
We can't pull it up through the firewall.
No, but does ICANN actually have that file?
ICANN has joint custody over the file with the U.S. government right now, and we're
patient rights with the.
And we're about to. Well, we have joint custody, and we're about to. We have joint custody over the control. Network Solutions is actually maintaining the file for purposes of the domain name root server system, and in about 2 weeks, I can now announce the file itself will be transferred. It'll be cut and paste into a computer in Marina Del Rey, which is where the ICANN technical offices are, Marina Del Rey, California.
At which point, ICANN's control over the net will be cemented.
Well, it's right. You can say ICANN's control over the net is cemented, or ICANN's technical management of a 256-line file will be cemented. Anyway, what that file is worth noting. It's called the primary root zone. The root zone is the set of files that has a list of names in the left-hand column and a list of IP addresses in the right-hand column. It's the phone book for the internet. It's the domain name system. The zone files are propagated and updated a couple of times daily by 13 computers called the root servers. Those 13 computers take their instructions from a single file, which is called the primary root zone file. That zone file actually is ICANN's only asset. It's the only thing that we actually have that if a bankrupt, you know, if we went into bankruptcy and the court started to dole out our assets, they would say, all right, you own one thing, which is the root zone file. ICANN's authority, therefore, is entirely derivative of its ability to exclude an entity from the root zone file. What that means as a practical matter is the operators of the registries. And the registries are Network Solutions for .com, .net, and .org, and then 256 different registries for the 246 different registries for the 246 countries that have two-letter top-level domain codes like .uk, .br for Brazil, .jp for Japan.
So ICANN could decide that .uk should no longer point to the authority in the United Kingdom that fills in all the names to the left of .uk, and instead point it to Ben.
Absolutely right. That's within its technical capacity to do. If it did that, however, I guarantee you that ICANN would be replaced in a matter of days as the keeper of the authoritative root zone file.
Who would actually do the dirty work of dispatching?
The root server operators, I'm confident, would point to some other file as the right file.
And the root server operators, recall, are the 12 mirror people. Remember that map up on the screen with the, you know, different places where the root mirrors were? He's saying that the 12 mirrors, so not the U.S. government, not the European Commission, not some judge, but 12 guys like John Postel would decide that they didn't want to take orders from ICANN anymore. Is that right?
I think that's right. And actually, when Paul Bitsey comes, as I understand he's coming in a few weeks, he runs one of the root servers and would be able to speak to the truly bizarre informality of the relationship of the root server operators.
Paul Bitsey is coming in a few weeks. He's actually a fellow that runs something called the MAPS RBL, the Mail Abuse Prevention System Real-Time Black Hole List. It is a private enterprise designed to cut down on spam. It is wildly effective, and indeed, just this morning, our own Berkman Center server was served notice by the Real-Time Black Hole List that we were in violation, and henceforth, our mail wouldn't be going anywhere. Ben was awakened out of a snug sleep and got us back on track, and Paul is coming to visit. So please be on good behavior that day when Paul visits. Okay, so we know now that the kinds of things ICANN can actually do repose in the raw authority it either shares jointly with the United States right now, but is ultimately to possess alone, subject only to a bunch of mirror people saying, we don't want to do this anymore, which is a real check on its power, subject to its own bylaws, which construct how it's supposed to operate, and for which if someone were to violate them, you could call upon the Attorney General of California, where ICANN is incorporated, and say they are acting contrary to their own bylaws. But they then have this power to exclude a registry, .com, .net, .org, .uk, from the root. And it's that power which you might suppose would ultimately bring the registry operators to a negotiating table with ICANN, where they then might take on additional legal responsibilities. It would no longer be the raw power of exclusion, but the power of a contract done by law that would say what ICANN could do and what it couldn't. It's that kind of power by which ICANN is working on the so-called uniform dispute resolution policy, by which the people that register names in different domains like .com.net and .org agree with ICANN that in the event that X, Y, and Z happen, they'll take away a name. Yes?
Do we need a domain name system? Could the internet work just with the numbers and then we'd have competing phone books, as it were, that would map directly? So you go to Yahoo, and if you don't like Yahoo, you go to another directory and say, give me Microsoft, and just give you what they think is the correct IP address for Microsoft. So basically, just a free market stuff.
Very good question. And the answer, strictly speaking, is yes. There are actually two ways to get around on the net, as we learned last week. There are the domain names that we're used to, and when you click, it usually translates to an address that includes a domain name at the front, or there is the underlying serial number address, the IP address, that you could use to get somewhere. So I don't know, do you know IP addresses offhand, Ben? Pull up a browser and just show how to get to the Harvard Law School homepage. The Berkman Center homepage, just using numbers. So here we are, 140.247.216.230. We hit enter. And that comes down, you want $100. Ah, there's the Berkman Center homepage, without use of a domain name. Is this not an effective argument, Ben, handed to Andrew on a platter as to why ICANN is not doing internet governance? Doesn't this take away the big club of enforcement that says you could take away someone's domain name?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the answer to the question is you bet. There's no need for a domain name system. The only thing that you can that I might say contrary to that is that. Most people perceive there to be a need for easy interoperability across the network. And people forget that the internet is more than just websites. The internet is also email addresses and a variety of other kinds of communication mechanisms. It's funny to think that you might try to remember somebody's email address with a number like that attached onto it, because that's what you would have to do. And in fact, there is no existing usable protocol that can be built into the common email programs that people use now. You would have to actually build a patch into it, which probably wouldn't be that complicated, but you can't really send email effectively using IP addresses alone. But that could be routed around quickly.
So let's bracket this question for just a moment. I want to finish off the question of nightmare scenarios that ICANN could do. Yes?
I've seen that the Kennedy story, an article I recently read, and Newsweek had a cover story on the internet and society, actually, and then one side story was on this kid who bought the site gwbush.com for $70, right? And he offered to sell it to George W. Bush for $350,000. And he turned him down because he just made his own site, georgewbush.com. The kid has launched a site at GW against him.
Can you pull up gwbush.com? Is that really the site name?
Yeah.
Ben, let's take a look.
And it has a picture of snorting cocaine.
Hypocrisy with bravado. Drug-free since 1974. There's Bush turning himself in. So it's not the most accurate news in the world, but... So there's the site. Okay, keep going.
Websites are getting to be such a big part of campaigns, as we saw in Massachusetts. What our guests are saying makes sense to me. What if someone bought up all the sites that you would think of to locate a such a kind of address?
It wouldn't have the opportunity to see that.
Well, keep in mind two points with regard to that, though. On the flip side of what you're saying, one is. A domain name is not speech. If you have to register this as, you know, ajax.com, you're still going to see the speech. Now, it might be a little weirder to try to find it, but, you know, the URL itself is not a form of expression. It's a router to help you identify a form.
Do we believe this?
Second point, would Jeff Bezos agree with you?
Mr. Amazon.com. Is Amazon.com just a domain name?
It's also, right, it's also a company name and a brand. And what's happened since businesses have started to go onto the internet is that they've begun to brand themselves. That's why trademark law becomes significant with respect to domain names. In fact, it's worth pointing out, trademarks are fundamentally inconsistent with the domain name system. The domain name system provides a single identifier for a particular entity. The trademark system allows for lots of different businesses in different parts of the company and different industries to share the same word, and they can each have a legally protectable trademark in that name. You can have a Joe's Barbecue in Austin, Texas, and a Joe's Barbecue in Boston, Massachusetts. It's bound, and they can both be trademarked. The names are bounded by geography. They're also bounded by industry. So you can have a Joe's Barbecue that produces that repairs motorcycles in Miami. You can also have a Joe's Barbecue that sells barbecue ribs in Miami.
Free slaw with every carburetor.
Yeah. So then, without getting into all the vagaries of that kind of law, that's the basic problem that we face. The other thing that's worth noting about George W. Bush and G.W. Bush, though, is that neither of those is trademarkable. You know, onhashforsenate.com can't be trademarked. And so the ICANN policy, and this actually annoys a lot of people, doesn't go to protect a whole range of different sorts of names that are not trademarks. I've been in Congress talking to people for the last couple of days, and everybody there is outraged about the fact that these people are going around and taking up Orrin Hatch. They took up Elaine Hatch, you know, his wife, MotherTeresa.com. I heard like six different people talk to me about MotherTeresa.com and what an outrage that it's being auctioned. There's no trademark in MotherTeresa.com. So
where do they auction it?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I know that eBay has done a couple of auctions of domain names, but
that was the next scenario I was thinking.
Oh, actually, well, you know, the funny thing about that, actually, just to be totally accurate, ICANN has one other asset, which is that ICANN has registered every single letter domain name in .com.net and .org. So we have a.com, b.com, c.com, e.com through z in .com.net and .org. This was originally done by John Postel because he thought he wanted to use them as part of a new network routing scheme. Ended up not using them, and we pay a couple thousand bucks every year to keep them registered. So one thing that we've been thinking about doing to raise money for ICANN if our financial troubles continue is just to auction them off. And I guarantee you we would get a ton of money for a couple of them. Anyway, so where do you auction them? I don't know. You contact the person that you think has the legal interest and offer it to them for a certain amount of money.
Often, there's also this so-called Whois server where you can find out. One of the assignments was to figure out if your own last name was taken. Just quickly, how many people's last names were taken in .com? How many people found that his or her last name was not taken? How many people then registered their last name? All right, now who's the smart aleck who registered HLS, harvardlaw.net? Who registered harvardlaw.net? You did? Okay, we'll be serving you with papers. just stay put. Now, one way you could check to see if the name is taken. Ben, are you just surfing now? He's easily distractible. You know? Make sure he keeps scribing. Well, I've entirely lost my train of thought. What are we talking about? HarvardLaw.net. There are two ways to find out. One way is to actually just type in the name and see if it goes somewhere. And that's how you'll know if it's taken or not. Another way is to go to the so-called Whois database. The Whois database will tell you who bought the name and what information he or she offered at the time that happened. And there's a way to look for Whois, and there are all sorts of battles over Whois, because when you think about competition in the offering of domain names, the other big battle that's going on that we haven't really gotten into today, one way to have competition would just be to have lots of different top-level domains. And the com people have theirs, and that's network solutions, and then there's the biz people, and they have theirs, and if you don't like com, you go to biz, that kind of thing. Another way is to force competition within something like .com. so that there are multiple entities that could sell you an untaken name in .com. Now, there still has to be one master list. So this is what has resulted in this bizarre distinction between a registry and a registrar. And it's worth explaining because you're going to hear about it a little bit in our discussion list as it goes forward. The registry is the actual list. That's the authoritative list you go through to find out where the name leads. The registrar is the middle person who shuttles between you and the list keeper and just registers the name. So in the case of network solutions, what it has meant to introduce competition in .com is to say, okay, network solutions, people used to go to you, pay you money, register the name. Now people will go to other people who will then go to you and register the name. And the fee that the other people pay you will be less than the fee that you used to get when people came to you directly. NSI stays as the registry under this scheme, and then anybody, including Network Solutions, can be the registrar. I don't know if anybody here has taken antitrust. There are some interesting issues raised there that are getting worked out in real time as we speak. Okay, so pulling this all back around, I think there was actually one question. Yes? The principle of trademark law. G.W. Bush is not a product or service. And maybe Diane Cabell, I see back there, a cyber lawyer. Can gwbush.com be trademarked?
Normally,
So could a political candidate or political office holder just...
Question in the back. Yes. Domain name brokers.com. All at rock bottom prices. So to bring this back around, we were trying to come up with the worst things. Oh yeah, Chris, go ahead.
We
you can see the official voice coming on.
We are right now engaged in negotiations with Network Solutions that we think is going to make the answer to that question moot. So we don't have any plans to take it over. And if we decided that we needed to and began to initiate that process, I'm sure that there would be lengthy, brutal litigation for many years to come. So, I mean, yeah, once we get control over the root zone file, ICANN would have the authority to redirect it to some other database. And actually, so I'll leave it at that. We're engaged in negotiations right now.
Unless, of course, a contract with the person that has the .com file has ICANN saying, we will not exercise that raw power unless X, Y, and Z happens.
That's what you would expect a contract to say, yeah.
That is what I would expect a contract to say. Yeah.
Looking at your crystal ball, when you expect that there will be additional problems from AJ, there are problems with AJ.
Well, that's one of the four things that the U.S. government charged ICANN with doing. When ICANN was recognized by the U.S. government as the nonprofit globally representative entity to take over the technical coordination functions that the U.S. government had been paying for through research grants, mostly through DARPA, but also through the NSF, they gave us a list of four things to do. One of the four things is we're supposed to consider when, how, and whether to add new generic top-level domains to the root. We've launched the policymaking process. It's been kind of a fiasco so far. The way that ICANN handles it is it referred the question to its domain name supporting organization, which has primary policymaking responsibilities in the area of domain names, including new TLDs. That organization set up a working group, and that working group has gotten bogged down in some of the nastiest and most unproductive bickering that you can imagine. So as to the time frame, I don't really know. It's one of the things that this board will consider before it goes out of business in September 2000.
Now, I should add, this policymaking process as specified by the bylaws that Andrew talks about is exactly the kind of thing lawyers do. You're trying to come up with a system that will have due process in it and let people get represented and then come to closure and finale. I mean, classic civ pro fed courts kind of stuff in this new standalone system. Interestingly, there's a dearth of lawyers that aren't already hired by one of the parties to advocate for a particular system that may feed into a need that one of the given parties has. So there's actually been a dearth of leadership of lawyer as constitutionalist, lawyer as Madison, Jefferson kind of sitting down to design it. So as you might take a look at the ICANN bylaws, actually give them a read. It's statute, it's code like anything else. When you compile and run it, is ICANN. It's worth saying, is this the kind of thing I could do or I would want to do? I mean, here I am, most of us, in law school. Is this the kind of thing that lawyers could be helpful with? Interestingly, there aren't a whole lot of classes on constitution making. Even constitutional law generally takes the Constitution as a given and then worries about the doctrine that flows from it rather than how to write a new one. Some of the special projects you'll see are exactly in this area, and if you have an interest in it, there'll be a chance to indulge it over the course of the term. Yeah?
Is there any timeline that I can't control?
Yeah, there is. The timeline is set forth in a couple different ways. One of the ways is the cooperative agreement between ICANN and the Department of Commerce. Another way is in Amendment 11 to the agreement between the U.S. government and Network Solutions. And that's the amendment that directs NSI to transition to a situation of competition and to cede control of the resources it has authority over a two-year period starting in the fall of 98, ending in the fall of 2000. And the third source is the ICANN bylaws. When you put them all together, it means that ICANN will, in the next couple of weeks, in all likelihood, have direct authorship control over the primary zone file, and over the course of the next year, really, ICANN will assume control over the other elements of its structure, which is to say that IP addresses we already control, protocol numbers we already control, the root server system we're in the process of building a more formalized relationship with the root server operators, ccTLDs, the country code top-level domain registries, we anticipate having contractual relations with maybe in the 12 to 18 month time frame, and for ComNet and Org, it's going to be much more like the next 30 days, 60 days.
Okay. Yes, quick question.
Going back to ICANN's authority over the root server and the root file, you mentioned that if the other root operators would like to actually point
You answer. You might want to restate the question briefly.
Yeah. The question is, so doesn't it sound like, from what I said earlier, that the root server operators themselves could basically execute a coup? Couldn't they just topple ICANN by pointing all of their root servers somewhere else? The answer to that is yeah, absolutely. Now, it's a much more complicated matrix than that makes it sound, because the thing echoing.
a little bit of feedback, yeah. Well, how do I take care of that? I don't know.
All right.
Don't cross my arms.
All right, that's easy.
All right, so
I'll have to make up something to gesticulate about then. So it's a much more complicated matrix. It's not like the whole world just depends on the root server operators, because there is a significant web of mirroring that takes place below the 13 root servers. In other words, AOL doesn't query a root server every time an AOL member wants to go out and find a URL. Instead, they cache the data a couple of times a day, and in the case of a really big ISP like AOL, they cache the data constantly. That was not my cross times. Just bellow.
All right. So the short answer to your question is yeah. I mean, ISANS could lose its authority like that if it acted without the consensus of the Internet technical community, and in particular these key representatives of the Internet technical community, and that's the way it's supposed to work.
ICANN is not supposed to be able to do anything without the consensus of the community. That's what we say we stand for. If we stand for anything, it's that ICANN executes the consensus of the Internet community as evidenced through the structures that we've built. And so the elaborate Byzantine structure that ICANN sits atop of is supposed to generate community consensus on the technical questions that come before it. So if ICANN acts in a way that is inconsistent with that consensus, then yes, ICANN will get routed around, and it should get routed around, which is similar to what you were saying about the domain name system. If somebody can figure out a better way to do domain names that doesn't require a centralized bottlenecked resource like the domain name system as we know it, great. I expect that within a couple of years, ICANN will be obsolete insofar as the domain name system is concerned. And there are a number of ways that people are trying to work around that right now. They all tend to stumble into the basic problem, though, that multiple people want the same name. And that's why if you try to distribute the problem away from ICANN, you're just distributing it to somebody else to try to have to resolve.
So notice that a couple times Andrew invoked the word consensus, which leads to our other big question about ICANN to be thinking about. Before we hit that, though, I just want to come full circle on our prior question about ICANN and governance. We were thinking about worst-case scenarios. What's the worst thing ICANN could do? And we were getting at it by saying, well, what is its biggest stick? And then who could it hit with it? And the biggest stick turned out to be it could turn off your domain name. We've seen so far that entities downstream from ICANN, like Network Solutions, can turn off your domain name. And they do so if you are the loser in a process where somebody challenges it for trademark-related reasons. It may or may not conform to actual trademark law. It's not in a court. But they'll make a decision. They'll put the name on hold, and therefore you lose use of the name. For a while, they had a couple other areas in which they exercised control. They refused to register the 7 dirty words. George Carlin's 7 dirty words were not available for registration with ICANN. Indeed, my phone rang about a year and a half ago from an irate guy that said, I definitely need your help on a pro bono public interest case. And he was full of it. He had tried to register it and was denied and said, it's a First Amendment case. You know, it's freedom of speech. And I gave him the old domain names are not speech line that Andrew had so well rehearsed. He wasn't quite happy. I think the case was ongoing. And, of course, eventually Network Solutions just recently abandoned the policy, gave out the names. Now, of course, there's a ton of people said, but I wanted the name and asked for it, and he told me no, so I should have gotten it first. The so-called Oklahoma land rush problem, which would come about, indeed, if you tried to introduce any new top-level domains. It's not good computer science to have everybody queue up and start pinging the server to be the 12th caller to get, something.biz right as it comes about. So actually figuring out how to release these new names to the public without there being an immediate auction. You might say that's what auctions are for. You just figure out who's willing to pay the most for it. But if you don't think that's how it should happen, you then get into lotteries and first come, first serve and other questions that are yet to be solved for the introduction of new generic top-level domains. Another example of control exerted through domain names comes from China. China is primarily China's ISP, or China contracts with the parties that are China's ISPs, ISP being Internet Service Provider, the people that you call on the telephone with your computer to talk to their computer to get you onto the Internet. And China has long used the practice of, if they don't want you to get to a site, the way they'll block it is by having you ask the ISP, that's the first person you ask, say, hey, I'm looking for McDonald's.com, can you show me where it is? They then go upstream to the right tables held by Network Solutions and give you the answer. China just says, wait a minute, we're going to pass it through our own filter first. If it's on a forbidden list, we won't bother to ask. We'll just come back with, sorry, try again later, or please fill out the following form, and someone will be with you shortly.
And China's not the only. Saudi Arabia does the same thing.
Yes, indeed. Saudi Arabia has the form that you can nominate a site for such treatment. Or complain that your site has been given such treatment. So domain names, because they map to these numbers, have been thought of as a way of exercising clumsy control to be sure, because you could always put in the number if you knew it, but then you'd always worry that your requesting that number would get to the same people that saw you request the name, and maybe you'd be in trouble. You may also wonder that it's just really hard to keep all these domain names, keep track of them and keep them updated enough to filter them on time, but there's no shortage of labor in China, as I'm told, and therefore, you know, you can make a good show at trying to keep up with the changes in the domain name system. So there have been some isolated examples, 7 of them in the United States and others elsewhere, of attempts to use the domain name system as a means of exerting control. And that is certainly thought of as one of the worst cases where ICANN could then, through its contracts or through ultimately its raw power over the root, exercise that kind of control over things. And indeed, the people that feel themselves harmed by bad trademark law or by bad process masquerading as trademark law think that the nightmarish present is bad enough already.
And can I make a comment on that before you go on? And that is, you were talking earlier about constitution building. And one of the things that we tried to do and that the framers of ICANN's bylaws tried to do back before I was involved was to build a system of constitution-like checks and balances. One of the significant checks and balances is that in order for an ICANN policy on content to be implemented, it would have to be done, as you said, through the contract with a registry operator. ICANN itself cannot operate a registry. It's in our bylaws. We can't ever do the operation of a registry ourselves. So that means that if ICANN were to be able to execute that kind of order, the authority to do that would first have to be contained in a contract. And for ICANN to sign a contract with a registry, it has to go through a public notice and comment period. So before ICANN could ever even purport to have the authority to do that, it would have to make public the fact that it wanted to have that authority, and then the contract would be adopted. So ICANN relies in part on a kind of transparency and the resulting public scrutiny that presumably would come along with it. And the outcry that would result if ICANN ever claimed for itself the right to do that through a contract. So there is a kind of check and balance that comes along with the distribution of the actual executive authority away from, let's call it a legislature, which ICANN is sort of legislative in the sense that it makes policy. The
government, but it has a legislature.
It's like a legislature. The executor of the act of censorship or whatever else the nightmare scenario might entail has to be somebody that is fully independent and distinct in a legal sense from ICANN.
Quick question here. In the case of China, you need a license. But if you don't get the license, you might be able to do it, just like you could carry people for money without getting a taxi cab license. But if you're found doing it, you could be in trouble. Another computer that in turn is hooked up in a fast way to the internet.
But
yes.
If you're in Singapore and Singapore tries to block websites too, you can just call Malaysia. You know, there's nothing to prevent you from doing that, except for the fact that actually it's really easy to tell when packets of data are going over a phone line as opposed to, not packets, when you're using a phone line as a fax machine or a computer rather than for voice. It's pretty easy to figure that out. So if the Chinese are determined, you know, to find out who's using a computer in that way, chances are they can probably do it, if they're determined.
This actually links both to the Privacy Week we'll be doing and to the Crypto Week, which is next week. Is there another question in the back?
Yeah, probably most people went and looked for their own name. There was one organization that right before they started charging for registration went out and went through 10,000 last names. And basically got them all for free because they didn't know people they were charging. And then they extort people by saying, Zima, register your domain name and email.
Extort is such a strong word. Trying to enter into freely negotiated contracts with people. Yeah.
It's one of the things, you know, it really has to be part of the first. why should they be able to keep things that they got for free?
They can. I mean, they can. Do you mean they register these?
Yeah. But why? The whole Oklahoma land rights thing. They basically sued about 10,000.
They were there first, and with them are a bunch of people that were there not for what we're decrying as a nefarious purpose, but. You know, plenty of websites were registered before the charging took place that are just websites. And if you took their name away and said, well, we got to put it out for first come, first serve again, hope you win the second time, that certainly, to go to one of the touchstones that you'll hear in this debate, wouldn't contribute to the stability of the Internet.
Well, and suddenly, I mean, and the other thing is, look, I mean, so I don't get McLaughlin.com, which I can't get. I can get amclaughlin.com. I can get a-mclaughlin.com. I can get andrewmclaughlin.com, andrew-mclaughlin.com. I mean,
I think that guy's registering them all as you say it.
But, you know, one of my responses to that question is, so what? You know, big deal. So you gotta add another letter onto the front or the end. To a trademark owner, that's not a satisfactory response, incidentally. But
for you all,
but for me personally, I mean, who cares?
Indeed, the law is structured in a first come, first served kind of way. So now the other question, we've been going through the nightmare scenarios that ICANN could do if given the stick that it's about to get, a stick made up both of raw power and later of contract power over downstream people. A symmetrical question would be, what's the worst case if there were no ICANN? What if there weren't one? What nightmare could result then? It was gotten at a little bit by this fellow saying, you know, all right, well, what are the alternatives? Or, you know, can't we just have use of IP numbers or other systems? In fact, if you go into Internet Explorer and you just type in cars, instead of going to cars.com, well, there's a timeline. That's great. It'll actually look for things related to cars. And Microsoft, since it owns Internet Explorer, will decide where it wants to take you. So there you put on cars, and it takes you to CarPoint. Now, CarPoint is just Microsoft's thing. All right, so now Microsoft has a system that is not a domain name system. It runs in parallel with it, but you could see just starting to get around without using all these stupid dots. So you type in cars, you type in McLaughlin. Where does McLaughlin go when you type it into IE? Probably doesn't go anywhere yet, but IE could sell that to Andrew, and suddenly McLaughlin goes to something not related to McLaughlin.com. So there's always this threat opportunity of a new system taking over with the only, my lord, McLaughlin, what have you been up to? Oh, it's the McLaughlin Group. How about that? So you type in McLaughlin, it goes to the McLaughlin Group. All right, so this is another domain name system.
It looks kind
Which
of
one
lucky,
am I? Actually, the middle one, yeah.
I was thinking upper left, actually, but I don't have my camera off today.
So let's leave that question, actually, for the listserv. You'll see that this listserv, also called Major Domo, you're all subscribed, so far as I know. If you're not, you should be. I'm going to ask that you stay subscribed for at least a week, after which, even if your filters aren't helping you, you can leave. But keep with it for a week, at least. And notice who has been signing on. You've seen now, not messages from classmates. People either haven't realized they could post or been too terrified to post. But you've seen these guests coming on one at a time. And as they do, you'll see they each have a story to tell, and are quite an interesting group of people with varied views. They would be wonderful people to ask questions to. They're used to this. They sit much of the day, it seems to me, and do this. So ask them questions, and realize when you ask the question, everybody else in the class will see it, and the invited guests will see it, and then one of them will answer, and then one of them will argue with the other one, and then you can answer too. And use it as an opportunity to talk to the principals, some of the principals at least, in this debate. And one of the questions I think they would love to hear and wax eloquent about is, do we really need ICANN at all? What is the nightmare scenario if it doesn't come about? I have my own views on the subject too, which I'll be happy to share with you at some point. Okay, next, what does consensus organization mean? Because supposing you wanted to have an ICANN and you wanted to do it right, so let's just presume that you wanted some public trust authority to coordinate things like the introduction of new top-level domains like .biz. You wanted it to make sure that you didn't have bad behavior by monopolists downstream, bad behavior perhaps defined as price gouging or weird contracts they could force you into since they're the only source of a domain name. And you also want them maybe to do things like these uniform dispute resolution policies so that when you get a domain name, you are agreeing by contract, just as a person getting a domain name, to submit to a particular process for resolution of disputes about the name that others may have about you. If you wanted to do it, how would you build an organization? What would the building blocks be, the raw ingredients, of a consensus organization? How do you know what consensus is and among whom? And for that, why don't we rally up the one-armed bandit? The cold call app. Any given person's odds are low, right? We're going to need someone else. Okay, go ahead. This class is about the rule of law. Ben will be disposed of according to the rule of law. But before that, there's another person anyway. I guess I should at some point address the question. But let's let Michael Richardson take a stab at it first. And then I promise I'll do my turn too. Is Michael Richardson here? Go ahead. Yes, the consensus question. Somebody comes to you, right? You're a lawyer, and they tell you the whole story of ICANN. They hear what you heard last week. And you read some of these documents that were in the readings, and you see about the trademark disputes and everything else, and I say, you're a lawyer. Tell us, what are the building blocks? What are some ideas about building an organization that we could call a consensus organization?
I think one of the first things you have to be concerned about is the internet's viewed by billions of people. Like they want to be concerned about forming a group that would represent not just companies, but everybody. And I think by supporting workers, they have the people that are going to, they have certain directors already, but they're trying to figure out how to
direct the so-called at-large directorship.
At-large. So I think that's the main thing for the getting the at-large.
So how do we define an electorate? Presuming you had an electorate, you could come up with some kind of electorate scheme, hopefully not as hopeless as the city of Cambridge is, and have them elect their people. But so who can be?
Internet users.
So you let anybody who is an internet user register in the at-large membership and contribute a vote towards the at-large half of the board. All right, interesting idea. Let's get some reaction to it from someone else. Ariel Greenberg.
Yeah. Voting generally does seem to be much democratically, but you have a couple of problems here of people using the internet more than other people. People are not really understanding what these are doing. You have 6-year-old voting and 72-year-old voting.
So this is the argument, the way John Postel put it, as this kind of idea was put to him was, he said, some pigs are more equal than others. And he meant it with the irony that it obviously conveys. Remind me at some point to tell you my George Orwell story. But put it on the listserv, perhaps.
Can I ask Michael a question? Is it related to this?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. No, it's on some totally different topic. If consensus is to be expressed through voting, does a 51% majority vote represent a consensus in your view?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very lawyerly answer. That's several hundred more billable hours before I can come back to you with that.
Yeah. Did the class read anything about the IETF process?
I just read the DAO of the IETF and was orally told about the RFC process.
Did you go into humming?
Yes, we mentioned humming.
Okay.
So one question is consensus in a room, if a majority of people in the room believe X, should happen, do we have consensus around X? Or does consensus somehow call for more? This may sound a lot like jury questions, right? Majority verdict versus unanimous verdict. And in turn, one layer down, the standard of proof that a jury is asked to go by, beyond a reasonable doubt versus a preponderance of the evidence, concepts that, interestingly, are never defined, left to the jury to figure out even what they mean. And similarly here, we have consensus, and we're trying to algorithmicize it, to come up with a formula that does it. Both, once you have a board, can you say it's the consensus of the board when only half agrees, and even picking the board, is the consensus achieved that these should be the board members when you have an equal electorate? And the point here, of course, was how can every vote be equal when one person may have a much greater stake in how it turns out than others? Well,
and just one comment on that, which is that the prior question is, why on earth should consensus be the standard anyway? In other words, in America, we don't do politics by consensus. I mean, there is no consensus on the abortion question, or maybe arguably there is actually on the death penalty, but on really contentious, divisive issues, there's no such thing as consensus, and yet we implement policy at a national level anyway. We do it by voting. ICANN is supposed to be a consensus organization. Why? Well, it has its roots in the technical community, where the technical community does things by consensus. How can it do things by consensus? Well, because for technical questions, there are right answers. There is, in fact, such a thing as running code, as Jonathan said. The IEPF is abundantly committed to the prospect that you don't vote to figure out what the right technical solution is. Instead, you implement whatever the competing suggestions are, and you see what works best. And because of the nature of the good faith and goodwill of the community of technical folks that built the Internet, they were able to do that because everybody who participated agreed that if one idea was better and another one was stupid, even if it's your idea that's the stupid one, you give up on the stupid one and go with the one that works. When you move into the ICANN questions, which are essentially political questions, you are moving into an environment in which there's no articulable, scientifically provable standard or right answer. There's just no right answer in the sense that there was a right answer to the basic architectural decisions that underlie the Internet. There's no right answer to the question of whether trademarks ought to get protection while political and dissident speech automatically doesn't automatically get protection. So, to me, it's not even clear from what you're talking about why we need to have a consensus organization anyway. When that's
you're the guy that said it was a consensus organization.
Yeah, we are. I'm just asking you. I mean, why? Well. Yes.
So would it be unanimity?
It would have to be that somebody, the definition of the consensus that I see, I'm not saying it's here, would not be unanimity that everyone agrees, but that nobody significantly opposes.
So interestingly, notice that there are now two variables at play, not just how many vote yes versus no, but also how strongly they feel about it. Is the no person like, no, or like, hell no? And that somehow consensus is more lacking in the latter case than in the former case. Yeah. How do we have their voices, the voices of people who aren't yet using the Internet, since ultimately everyone will, right? We need to give the obstructionists a place in the organization to be heard. Yeah. How do we do that? That's a good question. Other thoughts? Yeah.
Just to speak more about consensus and why perhaps it's necessary for IT structure. Since the Internet is something that is perceived to be a global concern, I believe very much that consensus is necessary because this is not a decision-making process within the world.
Sorry to break your train of thought.
This is not a decision-making process just within a municipal jurisdiction, but it deals with issues that are of concern to basically the world at large. And if you look at international decision-making bodies, I think the move has been towards consensus. If you look at, like my colleague said, WTO, the appointment of a director general has been on basis of consensus. And perhaps that's, I believe that that's probably the way we should go, because you can't make a sovereign nation be overruled just because 51% decided that they wanted it some way.
Of course, the World Trade Organization has it somewhat easy. None of us in the room belong to the WTO, nor could we if we wanted. Right? The WTO, at the end of the day, the seats at that table are countries. And then you figure out, we know our electorate, they're countries, and then we figure out, all right, we've got to have consensus among them for an affirmative policy to come out of it that then binds in turn all the member states. It's a convenient formula. It's the same one that got our country started, but said only when a certain number of states, colonies, ratify does it come into force binding everyone, and ditto for amendments, things for which you want there to be consensus. But how do you do it when it's just people, not countries? It's everyone, unless maybe it should just be countries. Yeah, go ahead. Now, interestingly, ICANN has at different places in its Byzantine hierarchy tried each of these things out. There is, within the domain name supporting organization, which in turn is charged with electing 3 of the 19 board members to ICANN. How do they do that? Well, they have the Names Council elect them. Where do you get the Names Council? The Names Council gets elected by the General Assembly. Where do you get the General Assembly? Well, the General Assembly is people that come together to select the Names Council in a format that I don't think has been run wrong.
Sometimes slips up. The 7 constituency groups each elect 3 members to the Names Council.
So exactly your point, Ben. The constituency groups. What are constituency groups? Well, identifiable interests. Now, can anybody say, I've got an interest, I'm the Luddite interest group, I want my seat on the Names Council? No. The constituency groups get recognized by the ICANN board, and there are some constituency groups now, trademark, commercial.
Trademark, business and commercial.
Business and commercial are separate from trademark.
ISPs and connectivity providers, registrars, CCTLD registries, GTLD registries, and non-commercial domain name holders.
And there is currently a petition pending from the individual domain name constituency to be recognized by ICANN. There was a big battle over whether it would even make it onto the agenda at the meeting in Santiago. It was, and was told to wait, come back tomorrow with the broom of the Wicked Witch.
Although, I mean, it's interesting because that particular proposal looks great on paper, but then you realize that it consists of all of 35 individuals.
Yeah, there are many people who belong to each of the constituencies.
But, so there's the question of, right, so if you're going to have a constituency group for an individual users, how many should it have signed on board before you say, well, it's representative enough as a group of people to represent their interests? And in fact, this raises the question that Jonathan was talking about before about pigs being equal. The ISP constituency group says, look, our members are, AT&T, IBM, Deutsche Telekom, France Telekom, Telefonica, and all these other groups. We spent billions of dollars on this infrastructure, and you're going to tell us that our 3 votes ought to be equal to that of 35 individuals who come forward with a petition. It's a hard question to answer, actually, because you say, well, on the one hand, you're representing voices. These are supposed to be representative constituencies. But on the other hand, they say, well, not all pigs are equal.
Now, the Names Council had a meeting in Santiago at which no member of the Names Council wanted to chair it. So the first battle was who would be the chair. They decided on a provisional chair who would last halfway through the meeting, at which point there would be another provisional chair for the second half of the meeting.
That was because the first one had to catch a plane.
Uh-huh. There would be a, now it can be told, there was a second debate. At one point, they were arguing about the table. Actually, who would sit around the table and in what order, reminiscent of other arguments about tables in much harder negotiations involving military force. So the Names Council, you can hear on our site an archive, an audio archive of the Names Council meeting. It is extraordinary. At one point, the Names Council gets caught up, I'm going to get this wrong, and remind me on the issue that they were, oh my lord, caught on?
Yeah, so the issue...
Jonathan's example is one of complete parliamentary gridlock, and it goes like this. The Names Council's job is to structure the debate in the General Assembly. And the General Assembly is all of the individual people who want to be involved in the DNSO. It's supposed to be the forum in which policy consensus is built. So everybody's in the General Assembly, and there's a mailing list that basically is the physical place that the General Assembly meets right now. So the General Assembly gets its work done through working groups, and the Names Council creates working groups. So there's a working group created on the question of new GTLDs. And the new GTLDs working group has been doing nothing. It's just been spinning in circles and bickering, and there's been lots of moaning and controversy, but no real action. So they created another working group to come up with ways that the working groups can work better. That working group then dissolved into a pile of chaos because they couldn't come up with ways, because the ways that you try to resolve the gridlock will have substantive determinative policy outcomes, as anybody from the legal realist school around this law school will tell you. Process is, in fact, another way to resolve substance. So the process group then began to get bogged down. And so then the Names Council said, all right, so now we need to resolve the problems of both of these groups. They said, I move that we instruct the working group on process to recommend to us that we have a particular kind of more leadership-heavy, more tightly controlled from the top working group that we could use for GTLD. So they basically were fighting over a motion as to whether they would instruct the recommending group to recommend a solution to the working group that's supposed to be reaching consensus.
Ben has actually found this. It's motion one as amended. The Names Council instructs Working Group D to include, as one of the bodies that may be delegated to work on a specific issue, balanced working groups according to the following procedure. So it tells Working Group D what to say. Working Group D then says it back to the Names Council, which then decides whether to adopt it. So
if I can just sort of summarize from my perspective, this is not a good way to reach consensus. I mean, I actually do have an answer from my own perspective to the consensus question, but whatever it is not a little body that was elected through some relatively obscure process, taking majority votes about what process ought to be, and then for that matter, what substance ought to be. Now, I can have some structural solutions to this, but consensus is supposed to be a way for the basic technical non-cooperation problem that we were talking about before to be solved. You don't want to, I can't do stuff that lots of people are going to hate, and it's going to cause them to try to route around the whole system in a way that's destructive to the stability of the internet. Therefore, consensus is better than simple majoritarian voting, and so our structure is designed to produce it.
Let me be clear that at this point, the people in this room now comprise probably a third of the knowledge about ICANN in the world. There's probably a dozen reporters. There's about 200 people that show up at the ICANN meetings, and then assorted people actually associated with ICANN and the individual interest groups. Within this room now, if you've been following many of the bouncing balls, there is an expertise about this that most people don't have. And indeed, you can go back and even start reading some of the news articles and now realize where they're wrong about things, assuming that you think we're right and they're not. So this is something to work with, and as we use the mailing list, I again encourage people to step forward. I know it's always hard to be the first one, but ask some questions. You'll find interested, eager people willing to answer them, seeing perhaps in this group fresh bait to be converted to one side or another, and it can lead to quite interesting discussion. And for the rest of the term, this is going to come back to us. The ICANN annual meeting, first annual meeting, is in Los Angeles in November during flyout week, conveniently. If you're interviewing in LA, drop by. If you're not, it will be webcast, and there'll be an opportunity to tune in live and to remotely participate, to type in questions that will then be read onto the floor and could be the stone in the stream that turns the course of proceedings. We may even set up a room here where people want to, you know, come together, right, like watching the Super Bowl. Let's get together and watch ICANN. The ad rates are much lower, but you're now in a position to appreciate some of it. And I hope to have a sense of external relevance. Whenever you get in depth into an issue of value, something where people are arguing over ought, normative stuff, it always gets into politics and war stories and such. Anybody who's run a refreshments committee to high school can say this. But in addition then to the politics that are involved is the question of greater relevance. And I hope that we've gone some way to showing both directly why this might matter. We've left open the question of what would happen that would be so bad for the internet if ICANN went away. That question I'm hoping we'll find a way to ask on the list, and I'd love to ask somebody to ask that. Let's get the cold call thing up one more time. So Matt Anestis, are you here? So Matt, maybe sometime tonight you could post to the list the question about what would be so terrible if ICANN weren't around. So you are now nominated to do it. Well done, well done. Also a sense of some of the substantive content control that can happen. Also realize that as we go over all the other issues that are closer to the headlines, pornography, gambling, privacy, all that stuff over the course of this term, as we're looking for ways to come to resolution on it, when the resolution may be for a global internet binding everyone and therefore not suited to one country trying to take the lead, ICANN-like solutions come to the fore. If ICANN manages to do domain names well, why couldn't we also ask it through its consensus generation process to come up with a uniform privacy policy and a uniform pornography policy, et cetera, et cetera. So that's another reason why what happens here may be of great relevance for the future of the net. Another alternative to keep in mind is the net today may not be the net tomorrow. You could imagine a domain name system that is geographically based, one that asks where you are before it asks for the domain name you want to resolve. When you say I'm in Boston and then you say Sam's Barbecue, it takes you to the samsbarbecue.com that applies to Boston, not the one that applies to Michigan. And then there'd be certain names that are so-called famous that would be global. So remember that the internet itself could change. How would that happen? Through new protocols coming about, possibly through an ICANN-like process. Okay. So now we have our break, which comprises administrative stuff.
Oh, before I get off the hook here,
yeah.
Let me just take a minute and make the pitch, which was the price I extract for scrambling back from Washington today, which is that I'm in my capacity as a fellow of the Berkman Center, and in my capacity as ICANN's in-house lawyer and policy guy. I'm looking to find a couple of people to help out with a couple of projects that are ongoing at ICANN, and I'm interested in trying to structure it a little bit as kind of some either student work, or in fact Diane Cavill at the back of the room and I are volunteering to supervise some clinical work. So either for credit or for money, I'm interested in finding a couple of students to help me out with a few specific tasks. There are a couple of committees that have been formed at ICANN that I need some good staff work on, which means somebody to kind of monitor the discussions, do some research, keep things moving. One is on funding. ICANN has a big issue about funding right now, and we've convened a task force that's going to provide recommendations. 10 people from around the world in different capacities, and I'd like to have a student help run the mailing list, do some research on alternatives and legal issues, and present. There's possible travel out of this as an inducement. There's also a very interesting group, if any of you are technically minded. We've just formed an ad hoc committee, or are in the process of forming an ad hoc committee, which is going to look at the question of the future of numbering in the context of convergence between the IP network, the Internet Protocol Network, and the fixed and mobile telecom networks. As people are building new mobile networks according to different sorts of standards to handle new kinds of communications, it's not clear whether they're going to be building separate networks which have portals into the existing IP network, or they're going to be using IP addresses in the same way that websites right now do, and servers and hosts on the internet do. So for a variety of reasons which I won't bore you with, we formed an ad hoc committee of different people from the IETF, the telecoms, and sort of related interested parties to ask the question, so given that everybody's toaster and tennis shoe is going to have an IP number in the next couple of years, how do we go about handling the future of numbering? That's an ad hoc committee. I'd love to find somebody to help staff.
If you didn't understand that, don't worry. If you didn't understand a word of that, don't worry. Okay.
All right.
And if you did understand it, come talk to me. And there are a couple of other related things like that. And so those of you that are interested either in the clinical credit component should talk to me or Diane. And if any of you are interested in actually working, there's potential travel to the Los Angeles meeting in California for those who do work. And I'd also be willing to fork some money over for hourly time. So let me know if you're interested. There's lots to do. And I'd be happy to have some help through Harvard Law School and the Berkman Center.
Great. Thank you, Andrew, for that. So other admin stuff. Alex, Becca, do you have stuff?
Actually, what I wanted to do is just take a show of hands. Anyone is still confused, I wanted to see whether to take a class calculator or not. If you are still confused with the software, I reckon that there will be a lot of people. It would be afraid to put up your hand. If you are still confused with the software and I have enough hands, I'll do it right now in class. If not, we'll do it immediately following the class. So are you confused with the software? Okay, well, we'll do that after class.
So you could have asked people to close their eyes first and then raise their hand.
The other thing that I wanted to do was apologize for this week. We should have that bug that was in the software work.
Did anybody get the particular error when you get the email that says, please come here to answer your question, you go and it says, be very afraid? Did that happen? Did that only happen to me? I swear to God, this happened. And I
again, bug?
I guess so.
So I apologize for that. Next week we should have all that fixed up. If you sent email to me, that's great. I got it for sure. I'll make sure to get your responses in. If you got back a rotisserie question, an email message from the our software saying, please come to the site and respond to your rotisserie and someone else can answer it. Those are due sometime in the next 2 days. I believe it's Friday night at 1 a.m. Don't want to be doing that Friday night late. Or at least I wouldn't want to be doing that if I were you. So any questions on that quickly? Yes, Jeff.
Alex, what do you mean by respond?
So one of the questions was who owns the group? And we just had a class. And you might have someone, answered that question sent to you. You said something like, well, NSI owns the root. I mean, I love NSI, and you know, they should keep owning the root. They're a nice big company. I can stop and hear the other reason. So respond means take a crack at their answer. If you agree with this, you know, write up, these are supposed to be smaller, not 500 words or anything like that, but write up a quick, you know, I agree and this is why. Or if you don't agree, even better, write up a quick, I don't agree, and this is why. The idea behind it is to get a conversation going and to give you some feedback. Because we have a class of 120 students, it's hard for JD to actually get feedback from each person on your response, even though you will have to be amazing at that and reading it all from the reading. Yep, yes.
I'm going home to sandbag my house and gas the generator, so I was wondering if we might have a little bit more time to try to get that.
The dog ate my yacht.
The quick answer to that is no. You will have more time in the future.
But wait, wouldn't this be a good time for a skip chip?
Get your questions about exactly class. You can always use a skip chip. I want to just explain the skip chip quickly. We gave us 3 skip chips at the beginning of class. All and these are just to step back a second. These are in the computer next to your name in a database. There's the number 3 right now. What that number means is that when you press skip this question, I feel the exact words are something like use a skip chip here. The computer takes that as your answer. It doesn't bother you anymore for an important answer to that question. You'll have 3 of them.
And no salesman will visit. I mean, you're done, no penalty.
You're done, exactly, yeah. The other thing about using a skip chip is that there's no penalty, no hack.
It's a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Exactly.
And are they alienable? Is there a market in skip chips? I guess this is Harvard, not Chicago.
The answer is skip chip says yes, but maybe later before it's just So you could use a skip chip. So in answer to your question, again, this would be a great place for you to use a skip chip. It's too bad you have to, given that you have such a great thing you're going to do, same day, et cetera. But this is a good way to use pitches. Pitches are, we don't ask for what your reason is, you just use pitches. Any other questions on pitches in particular? Yes.
So when we kind of get into the area that you get from particular questions, then we're supposed to get a draft as the way sort of submitted.
Yes, and the draft ultimately becomes your answer when the deadline passes.
When we misconstrue Damien's draft, something like Damien's been edited later and later gifted as what we thought was the minion,
there's a possibility of my phone record. We're ready to be an option. We'll deal with that in some way. If that is the case, why don't you send me an email? You probably already did send me an email with your answers. If you did something like that, I did get an email.
We'll refresh the skip chip bank.
If you did send me an email with your answer or do so, say, 2 hours after class, we'll make sure that the new skip chips are refreshed and that your answer is in the
Well, along that line, if we play the skip chip, does that mean you not get our answer or do you still get the answer to the question?
I don't know the answer. But why don't you email me at ifhelp@eon.law.harvard.edu.
Yeah, ifhelp, there is no ifhelp@law.harvard.edu. We don't control law.harvard.edu.
Any other questions on if you have a really specific question, it might be better to just come to what I'll do immediately after class, which is go through the library and fly.
How long do our responses have to be? I saw you gave us word limits, so shorter.
That's probably a good question for JC.
How long do the responses have
my
to be?
My interpretation is when it said 500 words, in last year's class, was that we expected a good response to that question would be a 500-word response. Someone came to me and said, I can respond to this question in 273 words. Is that enough? And my interpretation was, if that's a good response, you know, go for it. Someone else asked me, I can respond in one word, who owns the root? The answer is perfect. It was that stop. And I would say that if we say 500 words, it might be better to add to that.
Network Solutions Incorporated. There is an old story floating around the law school of the exam, which I guess was in international relations at some point, said, how do we manage humanitarian intervention on the basis of universal human rights when we want to respect the individual sovereignty of respective nations? And there's apparently one student who thought about it in a 3-hour exam and just wrote, because we have to. And the professor wrote exactly and gave it an A+. I'm sure it's apocryphal. Don't try that here. But a substantive answer to this question is, first realize this system is meant to be interesting and fun. It is not meant to be a nightmarish chore. So my pledge is to try to fashion questions that aren't meant to catch you up or to just kind of desultorily see if you found the right thing on page 72 of the reading. So it may have been a little deceptive from the first week, because when you say who owns the root, you're like, okay, there's an answer to this. What's the answer? It was asked that way because there isn't really an answer. It's completely unclear who owns the root. And of course, ownership, as one person said, is a bundle of sticks, and some of the sticks are here and some of them are there. The key is to be able to sit in class, listen, be engaged, have fun, let Ben or whoever agrees to this take the notes for you. The notes will be available. Add whatever you want if you think the scribe isn't doing a good job. But really absorb yourself in it. And then when you do the readings, absorb yourself in that. And when you get the question, it's meant to be an interesting question with a real answer, not necessarily a particular answer, but one that's actually a real answer. Not one that necessarily gets you into the niceties of a particular doctrinal point. You'll see again, we incorporated this crash course in trademark law as part of the readings for this week. We didn't talk about it very much today. I mean, you'll have IP, some of you already have. That's where you can actually get into current U.S. doctrine, for example, on trademark law. But the point here is just to give you the background, the tools with which to give an interesting, thoughtful answer to the questions. So, are they hard or not when they're put that way? I don't know, sort of, because you really got to pay attention. If you try to do it at the last minute, it won't be any fun, and you're going to give a lame answer. Also realize that you're not really answering to me or to Alex or Becca as much as you are answering to someone else in the class. I see that there's a Rawlsian veil of ignorance over the question exchange. I am participating in this. So I gave an answer to the question. Somebody in this class now has my answer for reaction and critique. I have somebody else's answer for reaction and critique. It doesn't tell me whose it is. That wasn't a feature I asked for, but it's one we apparently are living with. So we'll make the most of it. So think of yourself as addressing somebody else in the class and realize that the questions will more often than not be questions of ought, for which you're supposed to create a view and make an argument that you believe in, rather than questions of is that are a simple doctrinal crank that you put things through.
I have two things to that.
Yeah.
The one thing to add to that was that we're not, if you do need it, exactly where we do it, the conversation between you and another student, we're not looking for, I'm sure they go back up on this, but we're not looking for a litany of the reading or the history of the Rinsky and that or anything like that, unless it helps you prove the point. So there's no reason to worry about putting that in if it doesn't help you.
Or it just helps you understand the question. Who owns the root is a completely senseless question, generally, but also one that's particularly senseless if you haven't done a reading or weren't in the last class.
Yeah, so the idea is not that you don't need to restate the reading. It's more to take a stand that someone else can disagree with. And then the other thing is that we will be putting up what we thought were some good answers from the first week with those names on the site. So if you have a question, like,
we should put over any other questions of this sort into, there's actually a threaded messaging base. When you go into the thing, it says, what do you want to work in? And if you click threaded messaging, there's a threaded messaging area, like Hyper News, with one message from Alex saying, welcome everyone. So feel free to post there, substantive or non-substantive stuff, and the IS help thing, which I think somehow we're going to make available answers that are useful to everyone for that stuff. By all means, make use of that. Anything else administrative-wise?
You have, if you have those questions to answer, they'll have to send you down. You can go to the site, which is cyber.law.harvard.edu/IS99, click on the courseware. And it will bring you to the site. You'll be able to see whether you have any more work to do this on Friday at midnight. Probably not very many of you have that work to do. The second thing is that this coming week, you'll again get some questions to respond to. Those will be due at the same time, Wednesday at 1 a.m., and then there will be a round of rotisserie after that, probably this Friday or Saturday night.
That's what you expect. The reading will be any questions on that, and then if not, I'd like to invite you to email my help. I'm sorry, I tried to do that, go to respond to the, I got a rotisserie thing, and I tried to respond, I went through the courseware, and it just brought me back to like my draft. I didn't see where to respond, and when you just explained it, I didn't see where either.
Okay, that's
useful.
What will happen is you'll get this might be a good place for Ben to grab it.
Let me put it over this machine.
And Jonathan, since you responded to the first question, maybe you could log in here. cyber.law.harvard.edu/IS99. Good. And courseware is where you want to click, get to the courseware. If you have not registered or registered in the very recent past, you will have missed this entire first week and you will have emailed your answers to IS Help. You will not have rotisserie answers to, you will not have someone else in the class's answers to respond to this week. So I'll start next week. If you have not registered yet, really you need to register right now. We will be playing your stitches on the last week if you haven't done the assignment. We really need to get you into the software.
So when I poke into this drafts folder, I find that the answers I gave last week went into my sent folder automatically. The answer I didn't give, I skipped one of them, went into my trash folder. And now in my drafts folder, magically there's a new message which represents somebody's response that I have to answer.
And if you click on that.
So there it is. There's the answer I have to react to, and there's going to be my reply. So that's what should happen. This is the thing that was telling me to be very afraid. So if it's behaving for me, it ought to be doing okay
for everyone else by now.
If you did not answer via the courseware for the first week, if you answered via an email to me, you will not have this exchange. Are these really general questions, or do you want to come talk to me?
Say 1 o'clock on Wednesday. You mean 1 o'clock Thursday morning?
Okay. This sounds very good clarification. Thank you. 1 o'clock Thursday morning, late Wednesday night. Okay.
That's a completely different thing. This listserv major domo stuff is just about ICANN. You've already been registered, or if you haven't, let us know. Completely separate from this stuff. Again, this is an experiment in which we're doing all the variables at once. This is why you need the sense of adventure. We still have another 8 minutes that I plan to make the most of, just to let you know. Go ahead. Yeah. You should, Alex will make sure that there's something on the site about it, general instructions, and if they don't appear in a timely fashion, email us and we'll let you know. As you can see, we're experimenting. This is part of it. This is to be exactly expected. In technology, it's the rule of three. It costs three times as much and takes three times as long as your best estimate as to how much it will cost and how long it will take. I don't know how that relates to the three skip chips, but it does somehow. Ultimately, this will feed into the question of what to do with the Ethernet at every desk. And if there are people that are intrigued by that question, that is one of the special projects I'd love for people to take on. It's my belief, for example, that one thing that could be done with them would be to have certain people in the class in turn define who their audience is to be. Who do you want to teach today? Your parents, your friends, some pals. You become the discussion leader of a course that is a satellite of this course. And we do a webcast live of our own course every week to the people you have designated as your class people. And it's your responsibility to teach them what you're learning here. Not everybody, mind you. This is not an assignment. This is a special project, which you are so inclined you can try. Otherwise, you can write the paper. But anyway, this is, again, another possibility of what could be happening with this Ethernet jack. What would you be doing with your downstream class to keep them oriented to what's going on in here? That's one of several special projects, which are too many to mention. We have some sign-up sheets up here for them, but instead of running through them right now, I think what we're going to do is send out a general email to the class with a description of each special project and give you an opportunity to say if you are interested. And again, if you're not, don't worry. You can still write the paper. Okay. Now, anything else administratively that I'm forgetting?
Just one more thing. After this class today, I and I think that as well will be down in front here. If you have any questions, either technology-related or community-related or any of the rest, feel free to come to us today after class. Another way to get in touch with us is email us. We have our office hours 9 to 11, I believe, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And then there's one other bit of office hours.
Friday 11 to 1.
So this is Friday 11 to 1. If you want to schedule a time in any of those times, just send an email to ISL.
And realize that all three of us see that. Alex and Becca we're all three together trying to spearhead this. And by no means are they meant to be a buffer between you and me or vice versa. So consider us interchangeable. All right, for the next 4 minutes, for which I budgeted slightly more time, this is why we always leave the administrative stuff till later. For the next 4 minutes, I'm going to give you preparation for next week. And for the readings. There are new readings available at the Distribution Center right now for next week. They are even scanter than this week's. And it's about cryptography. So I'm just going to give you the fastest overview I can of what to expect next week. So crypto, the issues. What are the issues in crypto? The issues in crypto, put very simply, are you can make better secrets, and the secrets you make in more areas in which you communicate are harder to discover, thanks to crypto. It used to be that you whispered, so they invented special microphones that could get you across a field. And then you went ahead and went inside your house, and they came up with bugs that you could slip inside a magazine. There was an arms race, particularly between the government and the people for whom it had legitimate purposes, or so it would say, to listen in upon. It's a primary tool of law enforcement. To the extent that
means of surveillance that the legal establishment has become used to using are now subject to cryptography. You get a warrant, you get to listen into the phone line, you can hear the mob boss say the incriminating statement. If that phone line is encrypted, if that email is encrypted, you're stuck, particularly if you want to listen in without them knowing that you're listening in. To serve them with the subpoena that says, please give us the password to your secure phone, would ensure that further conversations would be a little bit more vanilla. This is one of the major areas of crypto that is a point of disagreement, and you have the law enforcement and national security establishment coming against the civil libertarians who on just normative principles don't like it and feel that there's a creep going on that needs to be stopped, and against commercial interests. And you say, what do commercial interests have to do with this? Well, it turns out that the way encryption works, we're going over the parties right now, the way encryption works, there's a two-sided coin. And I was actually going to, for cocktail party purposes, walk through how encryption works. You have been spared that lecture by the exigencies of time. Just rest assured for now that which encrypts, that which takes something and makes it secret so that only you and the persons or people you want to see it can see it, is also that which authenticates. The same technologies that make secrets also let you say things with authority. Say things with authority mean things like digital signatures. So when you go to Domino's and you say, I want the pizzas, thanks to cryptography, you can utter it in a way that Domino's can rest assured that you really mean it and can't repudiate it. For commercial interests, this is really important. Everything from bank transactions to commercial, buying things, buying and selling. Anytime you see that little lock appear on the bottom of IE or Netscape, because now you're about to type in your credit card number, it's thanks to encryption. And it's encryption that is authenticating as well as making secret. So that's why commercial interests at times are divergent from the government point. The other thing to realize is that the primary means of regulation of cryptographic development so far has been on export regulations. So it hasn't in this country been, you can't come up with X kind of cryptography. It's too strong. That would be bad. You're not allowed to invent it. You can imagine such a law. They have refrained from passing such laws so far. Instead, the law says you can come up with strong encryption, stuff that's really hard to break, but you're not allowed to export it. What does export it mean? You can't send it overseas. You can't send the formula overseas. It's classified as a munition. And you can't teach it to somebody who is not a U.S. citizen. So if there were a non-U.S. citizen in this class, and I were to get into exactly how strong encryption works and offer up the algorithm, it might be so that I was violating United States law. There are currently warring bills pending in the Congress of the United States, one of which is designed to roll back these export restrictions, the other of which is to go beyond them and actually outlaw certain kinds of encryption or ensure that encryption has what's called key escrow. What key escrow is saying you're allowed to lock it up tight, you just have to generate a spare key so the government, with process, can come in the back door. You're allowed to have your secret phone, but you deposit the spare key with a third trusted party behind a courthouse door, or, a bank door, or the people that keep the Academy Awards secret, give it to them, something like that. And then if you get a warrant with process and you show to a magistrate, yada, 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 we can go get the spare key and then listen in surreptitiously to your phone call. Key escrow had been one of the cornerstones of Clinton administration affirmative policy, wanting to see it go forward. It's run into a bunch of problems, some of which you'll learn about in the reading, and which will form the basis of the discussion next week. Let me walk through the readings real quick. You're going to learn about COLEA. I believe that stands for Comprehensive Assistance to Law Enforcement Act. This was the means by which the government ordered phone companies who were busy going from analog to digital networks, they're upgrading their phone networks. The government says to the phone companies, you realize that by upgrading to digital, when we take headphones and literally splice into a line, instead of hearing, hi Hank, the money is buried under the green tree, instead we hear, psh, that stupid sound that your modem makes when you dial. So please see to it that whatever you build digitally has a special headphone jack for the police. That's what COLEA is. The biggest argument between commercial interests like AT&T and the government on this bill was who would pay to install such a jack. That was resolved, COLEA was passed, and now digital networks have changed, have at least kept the status quo as far as audio surveillance of telephone conversations, and perhaps even made it easier. No longer do you have to go in a sweaty, big, kind of cranky truck
and hang out outside and listen and hunched over. Instead, you can sit at headquarters and, you know, just kind of dial up who do you want to hear today. Okay, so this is the key escrow thing you're going to be hearing about in the readings. There's the SAFE bill, which is about loosening the controls, and then there are the other alternatives you'll read about. Also, you'll find Hal Abelson's critique. Hal is a brilliant professor at MIT who's teaching a course called something like Law and Ethics on the Cyber Frontier. This is a course that will be joining us next week. We will assimilate them. There's only 30 of them, I think. So they will be dispersed to the room. MIT undergrads, ripe for the plucking. They will be here along with their respective professors, and we're going to have a panel to discuss the issues. There'll be other points at the term. You'll see them noted on the schedule that's in the first readings as to when that will be. Also realize that there is breaking news. There's a press conference to be held at 3 p.m. today. I don't know if it was moved because of the weather, but 3 and 4 p.m. were key dates. You'll find out if you go on to the various cyber news sites like news.com or ZDNet or even, you know, the Washington Post online, you will see articles about cryptography and a new Clinton administration move to come to a resolution of the debates I've been describing. So take a look online for that stuff. And finally, there's some readings that bear on the technology. I have not had the benefit of giving you an introduction to technology, so go lightly on them. Don't worry if they don't mean anything, because we haven't gone through our introduction here. Also, there's a final reading and a reference about lobbying. Next week is not just about cryptography. It's about how, when it's an internet issue, you lobby about it in Washington. Is there anything different about getting internet issues through Congress than about getting, you know, tobacco subsidies through Congress? We're going to have some people here to talk about that. Here they are. The MIT class will be here. Danny Weitzner will be the professor with them. Alan Davidson will be here from the Center for Democracy and Technology, who has personally lobbied Congress as a civil libertarian on these issues. Jonah Seeger from a company called Mindshare will be here. These are guys that do internet campaigns. You have an issue, you hire them. They see to it that the internet is deployed to make your issue stronger. And we are working on some other interesting guests as well that may materialize. So that was a 4-minute lecture on cryptography. See you next week. Yeah, we'll see to it that they're up on the website immediately.
And when breakfast?
I hope so.
Whether it's conducive to walk back?
I know.
Did you stay in the dorm? Or?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. But is it just around here?
Yeah, it's about 15 minutes.
Oh, okay. You're lucky.
You?
I stay at Peabody Terrace.
Oh, okay. That's quite a walk. Yeah, it's market.
No.
Up that way?
Sorry, down towards the river.
Oh, it's that way, oh, sorry.
It's down Mount Urban Street.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, it's, the other one is Terry Terrace.
Just to,
yeah, I guess. Oh, well.
Oh, is that the one that overlooks the river?
Yes.
Ah, I've seen the picture. It looks really nice.
Yeah, it's very, sunny.
I don't have kids.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, if I get lazy of walking, then I probably will get back in the room. But so far, it's okay.
Okay,
see you around. Okay, thank you.
I want to.
Someone know Alex's email address offhand? At MindFriend? That's good until the end when we lost the screen. Alright, now I gotta put this away. Oh no, I've missed my dinner obligations already. That was predictable.
You
No one told them to, and that's just like, you know, $100,000. It's a good move, but that's a major flaw. But that would be added. I mean, I can guarantee you that would be added.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's scary to think what happens. I mean, I guess I shouldn't have to be worried about it, but. Here it seems like the room is so polished that there's no way to fix the problem.
It comes down to your like 10 minutes, and then you put it you put it in, and that's going to go down the contact of the tree. You kind of check it out, and that's going to
So what do you suppose the connection is from here? So you can imagine it being some type of computer, or you can imagine it being a control. And that really does control everything.
Yeah, that's the feeling. That's the feeling of relay. Imagine it's a
feeling. Right.
And, relay to dirty. They get dirty. They get like, not get dirty.
Right. Well,
you got exercise. You got
a little energy. Best of luck, and I don't know what it is to wish you luck doing and making it good. I haven't thought about stuff on that level at all. You know, I'm still in the world of connecting wires every day the way I need them for that day. It's sort of a fun place to be, but.
Thank you.